You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 32 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
You are coming in hot.
So ready to podcast today.
You are.
I have so many things to
talk
about. I
was so ready to podcast on Sunday night after the Seahawks game, and you apparently were not ready for that.
I was in a new state to podcast. I was full of tears about Earl Thomas at the time. But we have many things to toast.
We do.
Right?
That is true.
We have many things to talk about. I was thinking what we do is an all-round-up episode. Everything we do, we hit it quickly. We get in. We get out.
Even the Seahawks preview?
No, we'll do that for a little bit longer.
Okay. Well, what's first up on your roundup agenda?
Well, first up on my roundup agenda is what we're drinking, because we can't toast unless we're drinking something.
That's a valid, very valid point. And what are we drinking?
So I just determined this a second ago, by the way, without telling you, is that this is B-Bomb month on the Fabulous Podcast. I think we could drink a B-Bomb. Well, we have special Christmas beer to drink, which is not B-Bomb.
We do.
But so last week we drank...
Do we have two special Christmas beers to drink or just one?
I did numerous.
Okay.
We're going to be doing a lot of podcasting on Christmas.
That's a fair point.
But so last week we drank...
The Christmas gift to you, the listeners.
We drank a 2016 B-Bomb, right?
We did.
This week we're going to step it back to the origins.
Yeah. And to the roots. Going back to my roots.
A Fremont Winter Ale, which is the beer that they subsequently put into bourbon barrels to age.
Yes.
So this is the beer that's being aged in the bourbon barrels.
This is really like a poor man's B-Bomb, isn't it?
It's significantly cheaper. We're talking this is $16 cheaper than a B-Bomb. How much could those bourbon barrels be worth?
It's literally a poor man's B-Bomb.
Yes. I didn't make you pay for it. That's how much poorer I was.
That's a good measure of it, yes. Would you like to tell us more about the Fremont Winter Ale?
So rated an 85 on Beer Advocate.
Ooh, that's way lower than the B-Bomb.
Well, of course, right? It's $16 cheaper here. So it previously was called Abominable, the Fremont Abominable Ale.
Yes.
And then they had some sort of copyright issue this last year. Are you familiar?
Abominable is like the Abominable Snowman copyrighted itself? Yeah. Huh, impressive work.
You know, the Abominable Snowman's all about branding.
Hashtag on brand.
He has to cross-collateralize. And so he's like, this beer can't fly. It's not going to happen unless I'm getting profits for it. So they're like, all right, we can't share profits with a mythical beast.
Especially because you don't exist.
They changed the name to Fremont Winter Ale, added some geese on there.
I was curious about that because I was like not familiar with the Fremont Winter Ale, and I was wondering, had I completely missed the Fremont Winter Ale?
A lot of people think that it's a completely different beer, but it's just the rebranded Abominable Ale.
Okay.
They had to keep the B-Bomb branding, but I think they could keep that because it doesn't have the word Abominable. It's just B-Bomb.
It does not.
Right? So this is the same beer, right? It's what we call a winter warmer, an Imperial Winter Ale. This is a tasty winter ale to snuggle up to, released for the winter months when snow blankets this terrain, which not often in Seattle.
But it did on Monday.
When snow blankets the terrain of the mind and the body. I'm reading this all wrong. Something's weird here. When snow blankets the terrain of the mind and the body craves warmth. And let's be honest, it's dark and wet most of the time, so your beer better be damn good. Winter ale is dark like the weather, with roast chocolate and warm malt flavors balanced by noble hop aroma and subtle hoppy spice. Warm up to it.
Well, that sounds good, but not quite as good as B-Bomb. Question about the snow.
It sounds like $16 cheaper.
It does. Question about the snow. So,
yes.
Babyist Fantasy Genius saw snow for the first time.
You know, he had seen snow a year earlier, but I think I've documented this well. Maybe we'll talk about this during the music episode coming up next week. Children don't remember anything that happened the previous year.
No, wait, Baby Fantasy Genius had seen snow or Babyist?
Both of them had seen snow.
I mean, Babyist maybe had seen snow at like Mount Rainier, but
yes,
not in the backyard.
No.
This was the first time that it had snowed.
Yes, he thought it was rain.
Okay. And is it true, as your Instagram said, that within minutes of being out there, he knew to throw a snowball at you?
Yeah, especially at me. A lot of people learn to throw snowballs at me very quickly.
I mean, clearly I did.
Well, you remember, I was going to propose a bet to you on this podcast.
Oh, no.
And our most famous bet ended with you being struck by a snowball. Let's come back to that in one quick second. Let's pour this beer first.
Okay. The memories are painful. They are very painful. Fortunately, the beer will relieve it.
I'm trying to think. While I'm pouring this beer, can you try to remember what the bet was about that you were struck with a snowball?
I feel like it was it about whether the Seahawks would make the playoffs in 2003?
Was it 2003? I think it was a Seahawks playoff bet during the Mike Holmgren era.
That sounds right, and I think that's the correct timetable, because I think I was still in college, and I don't think we would have been that surprised about the Seahawks making the playoffs in 2004, because they had made the playoffs in 2003, which was, of course, the famous Matt Hasselbeck, we want the ball and we're going to score year.
Yeah, that continues being great.
Oh, that'll never not be great. That'll always be a joke.
I'm always happy when people reference we want the ball and we're going to score. All right, so we have some things to toast here, right?
We have many things to toast.
Okay, what are we toasting to first?
Huskies in the college football playoff. That's number one right off the bat.
Speaking of babies, watching this college football season with a four-year-old has been kind of insane, because he thinks this happens all the time.
He's like, what, you don't constantly go 11-1?
I'm like, you should have been there when we were playing Oregon State in 2007 in the pouring rain, and our quarterback was injured for the season, and the same game happened 4 or 5 years in a row.
It really did.
Every quarterback that we had was injured for the season in the pouring rain against Oregon State.
It's funny because it's real. I was hearkening back to, like, in 1992, when I was 10 years old, and the Huskies lost to Arizona after previously having gone undefeated the entire 91 season and started 8-0 in 92. And it was, like, the first time I remember the Huskies losing. Yeah. And I was like, what even is this? Why is another team running out the clock against us? How is that legal?
Well, another thing that we're toasting, speaking of the Huskies, Marcel Reese coming back home.
Oh, coming home. Cue Skylar Gray.
I mean, how long have we wanted Marcel Reese to be on the Seahawks?
Since he was on the Huskies, I believe is the answer.
Or maybe when we realized that he was a quality NFL player.
Yeah, because we didn't necessarily realize that when he was in college.
This week, unfortunately, there was one Husky in and one Husky out for the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. Kevin Smith was released from the practice squad.
I don't know that I really count the practice squad.
But still, you know.
Yeah.
It was one former Husky wide receiver out, and another former Husky wide receiver now playing fullback / H-back in.
/ third down back.
But look at Marcel Reese. How excited are we for this?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. We'll talk about that during the Seahawks section. Probably not. We're probably not going to talk that much more about Marcel Reese.
All right. What did we want to come back to here? Was there anything more on the beer?
What do you think of it?
It's good. It's not as good as the B-bomb.
It's not even close. Really, I mean, it's actually kind of shocking how much those bourbon barrels change a beer.
You should probably drink this first and then the B-bomb instead of the other way around. I think it would be my assessment.
Yeah, it's good. It just doesn't have the same richness and liquory flavor. So
Sweetness.
Next week, we're going to try to drink, speaking of sweetness, the coffee cinnamon B-bomb. Hopefully the 2016 version.
You're going to be on the lookout for this in the wild.
Oh, yeah. I'm always on the lookout for it. I'm looking out for abominable snowmen everywhere.
You're driving around. You're like, get your head's on a swivel. That doesn't really translate me doing the head on a swivel motion.
Okay, so
we had a lot of things we wanted to get to.
I had to talk about. I know we don't like to talk about fantasy football on this podcast too much, right?
Which is weird, because it was originally one of the core topics of the Pelton Cast.
This is a bad core topic. We were going to talk a lot about tailgating and a lot about fantasy football.
Turned out there's not that much to say about tailgating.
I'd be like, relish. Feelings?
We supported cream cheese, and that was basically it.
Yeah, after we had our cream cheese platform, there wasn't a lot else to say. But so I had to talk about fantasy football for 1 second, right? Because you call me the fantasy genius on this podcast. Has never really been explained since we...
You call yourself the fantasy genius. I just go along with it. Don't put that on me.
You know, you came up with this name for me, and I just play along, pretend like it's a good nickname. But it's because in the fantasy league that you and I both play in, right?
Along with Mrs. Fantasy Genius, our cousin... other people who are not family members, but are in fact friends.
Yep.
Yep.
Other human beings. Thanks for explaining that. in this fantasy league that we play in, right?
A handful of people who listen and a handful of people who do not listen.
I have won the fantasy football championship. We've now, this is our 10th season. And of the 9 seasons that we've completed, I've won 6 of those 9 seasons.
Just a lot of lucky breaks.
I thought that I had 2 separate three-peats. Last year, I lost by 2 points in the fantasy football final because of Chandler Catanzaro. Still totally fine with it. Not bitter at all. I missed a 4-peat, right?
Okay.
So the reason that you call me the fantasy genius is because of all these wins.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty self-explanatory.
And this year, luckily, I have a good team again going into the playoffs. And I'm set up in such a good situation that I'm playing a team in the first round of the playoffs who scored a 51 last week. That team actually made the playoffs.
And that team tied the record for most wins in our fantasy league in the regular season. And obviously that team is my team.
And that team is you. I got a lucky break by playing the team with the fewest amount of points in the first round of the playoffs. And there you are. So, are we toasting to that? No?
I suppose so. Are you proposing? So, the bet you're proposing, is it based on the outcome of our fantasy matchup?
Well, that's what I was thinking. So, the greatest bet that we ever had was this this bet about whether the Seahawks would make the playoffs in 2003. And apparently, I won.
Well, the Seahawks did make the playoffs in 2003. So, if that was it, you definitely
won. What happened in those playoffs?
I just told you that was the we want the ball and we're going
to
score.
Oh, that was
again.
The year? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I thought it was one of the numerous years they lost to the Rams in the first round.
Yeah, that was 2004.
But so the bet was.
The original bet was you cracking an egg.
I would crack an egg over your head. And you decided, you got cold feet about cracking an egg over your head. I don't know what would have happened to me. But it was snowing outside when this happened. You decided you didn't want an egg cracked in your head. So you said you get one snowball, one free snowball to throw at you, right?
Yep.
And so we all gathered outside at our grandparents' house. I built up the snowball. You were standing there. And I threw it as hard as I could.
I covered my face.
Boom!
Which was a mistake.
Right in the nuts. And then you went straight to the ground, hilariously. Straight to the ground. Laid there for a way too long period of time.
Probably at least 15 minutes.
And then you angrily walked home in the snow. It's like a 25-minute walk that you did angrily all alone in the snow because you got hit with a snowball.
It's maybe the most significant pain of my life.
So I was going to say, is there some sort of bet that we could propose around this fantasy football
match? Similar to that? Or
I mean, it
separate?
Doesn't have to be a sequel to that. I don't know if I necessarily want... Losing to me will be the second most significant pain you felt in your life.
I feel like we should come up with some sort of podcast-related bet. Like, someone has to... I don't know what embarrassing thing they would have to do on the podcast.
Oh, what could that be?
But that's it.
We're turning into, like, a Howard Stern show.
Maybe there's some sort of, like, childhood photos we can post on the blog entry of...
Oh, we should post those anyway.
Yeah, we should. That's a good point.
Something of me with a rat tail.
Those are the photos from a couple weeks ago of us on the playground. Those are embarrassing enough.
We have to come up... We have a couple weeks here, right?
We do. We have time.
Because it's a 2-week playoff. So we'll come up with something good. But it has to be something that we do for when I inevitably beat you in the playoffs.
Yeah, so I'm going to make it so it's more embarrassing for you than for me.
Oh, you're going to handicap it like a point spread?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to discuss here?
You said you wanted to say something.
I wanted to tell you how wrong you are about something.
Okay.
And that something is a restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And that restaurant is Tortas Condesas.
Oh,
which I went to.
I've never been there.
You've never been there?
No.
Wait, I thought you actively disliked it.
No.
Oh, it is amazing. I went there tonight for the first time.
Really?
Yeah. Turns out, one disappointing thing I learned about it is they don't have indoor seating.
Okay.
Which is normally probably not that big of an issue, but when it's 30 degrees outside, kind of an issue.
You had a frozen torta?
No, but I sat outside for like 10 minutes waiting for them to make it in the extreme cold before walking back to my car and eating it in my car because that was the warmest place I
could. You should have walked into Montana while you were doing that.
I probably should have, but I didn't. But once I had this ole mole torta, it was the finest torta I have ever had in my life.
Wow.
And I have been to Tortas Frontera in the O'Hare Airport.
Wow.
It was highly regarded.
Wow. What is this place called?
Tortas Condesa.
Tortas Condesa. Better than Tortas Frontera.
Yes.
Wow. I've never been there before. I've just heard bad things.
Well, those things, I don't know who told you those things, but I dispute those things.
It was probably every single one of my coworkers. I mean, I walk by there every single day.
I would like to throw a snowball at people that said those things.
Wow. I'll tell them tomorrow. Right in the kisser.
it's on Olive Way. Not far from the I-5 exit there. And yeah, it was phenomenal.
I mean, I walk by there literally every single day. Well, not on weekends, but I walk by there literally every single day that I'm working. And because of these negative reviews that I've heard from various people, I've decided not to go there. So you're telling me that they're completely wrong?
They are steering you wrong, good sir.
Wow.
It was great.
I can't defend it because I've never been there before.
I don't know if I would say it. So the last time I went out in Capitol Hill, before this, I went and ate tacos.
Okay.
Help me out here. Tacos Chuki's.
There you go. There it is.
And I gotta say, this might have been better.
Whoa!
That's how good it was. I don't want to jump to conclusions on that one.
That might be too far. So you got an Ole Mole?
Yes.
Better than Tacos Chuki's?
Yes.
Oh man, I don't know how I can't agree. I've never been there, but I can't agree with this.
It's a bold statement. I know that. But it was very flavorful.
This torta, I don't know if I've ever even had a torta in my entire life. What are we talking here? It's like a Mexican sandwich, right?
Basically, yeah. So I'd have to look up what actually was in the Ole Mole. But
Ole.
The torta itself, the sandwich bread, very good. And like I said, quite a flavorful. And a lot of meat, too.
All right. I'll go there. I mean, I can stop by there anytime.
You really can.
So I'll go there.
This was braised beef mole.
Do you know what I had on Sunday while tailgating for the Seahawks game?
What did you have?
Did I tell you about this already?
No.
I had a burger. So before we walked over to the tailgate, we stopped at Paseo and had a Cuban sandwich, right?
Okay. And then on top of that, you had a burger?
Yes.
Wow.
This was lunchtime. Had a Cuban sandwich. Walked over to the tailgate, and they're making burgers with Krispy Kreme donuts as the bun.
Intriguing. So I've heard of this.
I had to have one.
It's never been something I've actually been that interested in, but was it good?
It was so good.
Really?
It's amazing.
That seems to be like too big of a confluent, like a contrast in tastes.
No, I mean, you know, the Krispy Kreme donuts are really soft and fluffy. It worked out very nicely with the burger.
Huh.
It was so good that I had the burger and ate the entire thing immediately after eating a full Cuban sandwich.
I'm going to encourage you to see a doctor now.
And meatballs on the side, too.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
That might have been why I was in no shape to podcast.
I'm getting a little sick to my stomach just hearing about this description.
If you're ever in a situation to have this, though, especially the fresh Krispy Kreme donuts, because they're so soft and airy.
Okay, wait, did the sign say hot? Sensei hot?
I don't know. Is that a Krispy Kreme?
When the donuts are hot.
I didn't buy the donuts.
That's what it says. Herm Edwards is very insistent on this. One person who listens to the podcast, who might listen to this podcast, will get this joke.
Okay.
But hopefully they get it.
Okay, it's not me.
Apparently not, even though you watched this Hard Knocks season with us.
What year was that?
The year that Herm Edwards was on it.
He's the kicker year.
Yes.
That's all I remember. How much do I...
He told someone to go get him Krispy Kreme.
And wait until the sign said hot?
The sign's got to say hot. It's got to say hot.
I don't remember this at all. Okay. He's the kicker.
One time in an elevator at my hotel in Bristol.
Wow. Name dropping again. Jeez. The other thing I wanted to mention to you... because we have so much stuff to talk about here before sports. We're going to yada yada through the sports.
Yeah.
Especially Husky basketball. I watched a television program, every single episode of it, per your recommendation.
You watched The Good Place?
The Good Place.
What did you think?
Not a fan.
Wow. Wow.
I've been waiting so long to talk to you about this. I've been waiting a very long time to talk to you about how I was not a fan of The Good Place. The best joke in the entire show was when they asked, do you know Kevin Paltonek?
It wasn't the Blake Bortles joke?
I didn't even hear a Blake Bortles joke.
Oh, there was definitely a Blake Bortles joke.
What episode was that on?
It was the episode where they find out. I mean, it'd be a spoiler if I told you. But it was the one that centers on Jacksonville.
I may not have gotten there yet. I have like 20 minutes left. I have half of the most recent episode that I haven't gotten
through. No, it definitely wasn't that one. Huh. So, I don't know. You just missed it.
Okay. Apparently, it's really dense. The problem with the show is, right? So, if we compare it to other Michael Schur shows.
That it's too great?
No. You think it's that great? Okay. So, there are two things that I'm stuck on. Number one, outside of Ted Danson, who obviously is great. Right?
Okay.
Ted Danson, undeniably great.
We can stipulate that.
In everything he does, provided he's not in blackface.
Which is very rare these days.
Happens almost never. And I like Kristen Bell also. Every single other one of the characters are so unlikable.
Wait, you think Chidi is?
Chidi?
You think he's unlikable?
They're trying to lecture this person about ethics. It is terrible.
She wants to be lectured about ethics.
Outdated philosophers, people who've, everything they've said has been so completely disproven, right? It's like a person.
How can philosophy be disproven?
Philosophy can be disproven. But the other
thing.
It's
a subjective thing.
So you look at Parks and Recreation, right? And Brooklyn Nine-Nine, the other two Michael Schur shows that we paid attention to. And also, he was involved with The Office, right?
Yes, he was a writer on The Office.
Casts of numerous characters who are all more or less likable and all semi-notable in some way. But then if you think about Parks and Recreation, right? Think of how many good characters there were on Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, they weren't good. They weren't notable at the start. They became notable because that show was on the air for so long. That's why they became notable.
I was personally early adopter of Parks and Recreation.
Other than...
Loved it from the very beginning.
Okay.
But...
First season took a little time to hit its stride.
I like those characters instantly, right? They're very likable. And on this show, you have characters who are supposed to be good, quote-unquote good. This is the other thing that I have to get to. Quote-unquote good.
Yeah, I mean...
But are completely obnoxious. And I understand that the point of the show is that good people are boring and obnoxious, right? Name-dropping. It's leading to such an obvious conclusion that bad person gets to good place and therefore shows good people that it's important to have fun every once in a while, right?
I think it's more that people are complex.
That's where we're going to with this. The other thing about it is the constant moralizing about...
You like Mark Brandanowitz?
Love Brandanowitz.
I like Mark Brandanowitz.
I was the only person. Like, apparently, you also were sad about this.
I don't know if I was sad about it. You did make room for Adam Scott.
I know. See, that's the thing. Maybe The Good Place will be redeeming because we have Adam Scott on, more or less playing his Griff from Boy Meets World character.
You're the one person in the world who would make that reference.
Who would want Griff back? It's when we were introduced to Adam Scott and fell in love with him.
Some of us fell in love with him.
But the other thing is this idea of good and bad that's portrayed on the show, right? It's such a high concept show for being a network sitcom.
Exactly.
But it's not executed properly. I guess I'm spoiled by prestige television, right?
Oh, God. I'm spoiled?
Because we're not talking about this vast world with thousands of years of history here and different relationships leading to different things over time and tenuous relationships and things balanced on other things. What we're talking about is like more or less some hilarious flashbacks. And no way can this compare to prestige television. We don't have jokes that are built up over weeks upon weeks. It doesn't even compare to a show like Community. Just not a dense show at all. But also the idea of good and bad, right? Because it's made me think about good and bad. And the thing that really bothers me is that they're not allowing understanding of how human beings make decisions, right? All that goes into human beings making decisions. And what it is it's like, this is a good decision, this is a bad decision. This is okay, this isn't okay, right? And there's all this black and white moralizing.
This is part of the joke. This is part of the whole thing.
I understand, but
I don't think you do get the premise.
The premise is that it's like setting these things up and then they're going to break down the barriers. But
they're breaking down the barriers.
Also, could you make one likable character aside from Ted Danson? And even Ted Danson's kind of not that likable sometimes. Only depressed Ted Danson was likable.
Well,
I mean, I'm probably going to continue watching the show because I've already wasted all this time. So I might as well continue through the rest of the season.
Your opinion is flagrantly wrong.
And I'm curious to see where Adam Scott as Griff is going.
This opinion would get you sent to the bad place.
See, I'd hate this. I hate the idea of good place and bad place. It's ridiculous.
Maybe this isn't the show for you.
Oh, there we go. What was the show that wasn't for you? Stranger Things?
Yes.
Yeah.
Should we talk about sports?
Sure.
Do we want to start with the Sounders?
Sure.
Because they got a big game coming up on Saturday.
Yeah.
The biggest game. We debated this earlier. This is the biggest game in Sounders franchise history.
There you go.
The what now? 9 years of franchise history? For the first time, they are in MLS Cup facing Toronto FC. So since we last podcasted, Toronto beat Montreal Impact in the conclusion of their two-game regular series. A wild matchup in the pouring rain that featured, what, 5 goals, I think?
7 total goals.
Well, it was 5 goals in that game because it was three. Oh, no, 5 goals to get it to overtime. 7 goals total. Yeah, you're right. 5 goals got it to extra time. They was tied at 5-5 when they reached the conclusion of the 180-minute aggregate series. And then in extra time, Toronto adds 2 goals to win the series and advance to MLS Cup, which they host against the Sounders.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're hosting. But I actually kind of – I think it would be more fun to watch the Sounders play against Toronto than it will be against Montreal.
I mean, in terms of big names, there's more going on. No Didier Drogba, but he wasn't even starting for Montreal.
I think Didier Drogba might be nearing the end of his career.
That's a fair assessment.
He's in what we like to call the MLS phase of his career.
You know who's not nearing the end of his career, at least in the MLS?
Who is that?
Jose Altidore.
No.
Who has scored 5 times in 5 playoff games so far, setting a new MLS playoff record.
I mean, their attack, when you take Sebastian Giovinco, who could be playing at the highest level in Italian soccer right now, and Jose Altidore, their attack builds up so quickly. It was kind of amazing the amount of opportunities that they're having instantly with Toronto.
You know what I find amazing? The fact that they were only 7th in goals during the regular season. Now, Altidore was injured at times during the regular season. He only played 23 out of the 72 games that the MLS plays in the regular season, give or take. No, it's not quite that many. But Giovinco was the bigger star during the regular season when he led the MLS in combined goals and assists. And he's maybe the best example of the MLS getting, instead of like Drogba, some of these European stars who are at the tail end of their careers and coming over to the U.S. or Canada in this case, someone who is still very much in the prime of his career but still can make more money in the MLS than he can in Europe.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to see Giovinco. And I think he's somebody who's come over and played well right away. He didn't take, kind of like Ladero that you see.
He, I was going to say, was the number two example of this, someone who's in the midst of his career.
But came over and able to play at the highest level immediately, not needing time to adjust, not needing to play against the competition or being overwhelmed by the physicality of the MLS, but just being a star right away. And I would say that they're probably maybe 2 of the 3 best players in the MLS overall.
I think so, yeah. And then Michael Bradley in Toronto has a 3rd star in their other designated player. You know, he's not as explosive offensively,
not
but a guy who just bosses the game from the midfield. And I am a fan of his work for the USMNT and the fact that he starred in the Italian Serie A before coming to Toronto. So it's, like I said, it's weird that Toronto's attack was not that explosive during the regular season, but then during the playoffs, they have 17 goals in 5 games.
It's crazy.
It's an amazing contrast with the Sounders, who have conceded, doing this off the top of my head, I believe 2 goals in their 5 playoff games so far.
That seems about right.
So it's a real offense versus defense, strength on strength, to some extent weakness on weakness, since the Sounders' attack hasn't been as potent without Clint Dempsey, but certainly they've gotten enough scoring from Ladero and Jordan Morris and company, and Nelson Valdez, who's had a very big postseason.
And it's going to be a much tighter game than Toronto played both of their games with Montreal.
Yeah,
right.
I would agree with that.
They're not going to be 7 total goals scored in this game.
It would be very un-Sounders if there were.
But I think it's going to be a lot tighter, and a lot of pressure is going to be put on that Sounders backline. People like Ramon Torres and Chad Marshall. It's going to be a lot of pressure put on them, but
I would say Jovan Jones really is the guy, because you've got veterans in Torres and Marshall, and then Tyrone Mears at outside back. Jovan Jones is the young guy who's been a little bit less reliable. He can't have those lapses in this game because Toronto is a team that is going to make you pay.
Yes. So the whole back line will be tested quite a bit, but at the same time, I would be shocked if they gave up more than a goal, maybe two in this one.
I could see them scoring two goals. We'll see how this game plays out. I think the Sounders are going to have the chance to strike on the counter in this one.
Absolutely.
And that's where Morris's speed is really going to come in handy.
It'll probably be, you know, typically soccer matches will favor one side on the possession. I would say that I would expect Toronto to control possession in this game. And the Sounders to, maybe similarly to what they did against Colorado, break through with a goal earlier near halftime. And then things might open up after that.
Do you think weather is going to be a factor in this game? The forecast for Toronto on Saturday, a high of 29 degrees.
Is there snow, though?
No snow. It's clear, but a low of 12. Which apparently, I'm pretty sure that's Fahrenheit. I checked it. I don't think that's Celsius.
12 Celsius is like 150
very,
degrees.
That'd be very hot. It's 92.
Is it really? That can't be right.
I don't know. Okay, I need to do the math now.
Okay.
It's not that high.
I don't think that weather will be that much of a factor, though. I mean, cold soccer players can play in, right? The ball might not move as gingerly, but they can play in it.
And then I think a good thing for the Sounders, and this is going to apply later in the episode, so stay tuned. The fact that it's so freaking cold in Seattle this week. Like, yeah. It's not going to be a shock. Like, they're not going from 60 degrees to 29. They're going from 39 to 29.
Yeah. They've been cold before.
They have. chances of winning? This is a tough one, isn't it?
I'm going to say 45%.
Conveniently, I was going to say 40%.
Were you really?
I was.
I think the Sounders are probably a better team if they were to play each other on a neutral site. But going into Toronto, I think it's a difficult matchup.
Yeah, I think whoever had home field was going to be favored in this game. Chances of PKs deciding this one? Maybe 20%?
That seems about right. I don't know. It's a real possibility.
Sounders have not, to my knowledge, had PKs all season long. I don't think they did in the U.S. Open Cup and then haven't so far in MLS Cup. So,
I'm going to cheer against that, but if it does happen, it'd be kind of fun.
It would definitely be very stressful. Much more stressful than we watch the Galaxy and Real Salt Lake have PKs in MLS Cup 2008 in Seattle. With no vested interest whatsoever besides not wanting Landon Donovan to win. And by the way, mazel tov to Landon Donovan on his second retirement. Oh, he just announced that.
Congrats.
Another retirement.
I hope he has a lovely second retirement.
May it be more fulfilling than his first retirement.
on his second retirement. How do you celebrate if the Sounders win? Celebrating when you're not at the game, a championship, is always strange. We're not going to go out on the streets and riot.
I don't think there's going to be fireworks. I don't know.
Just high five. High five and look forward to this Seahawks game the next day.
Sound handshake.
Yeah.
Just feeling of enterprise. Some texts to people who are Sounders fans.
Yeah. Congrats, Tex. Just knowing that we've done something that Portland did last year, but we're the champions now. Just knowing that Portland won't be able to hold that over our heads.
That's very true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to the potential.
I hope for that.
Toronto will probably riot, though.
Yes.
And what about Husky basketball? Did not fare so well last week.
Well, they got off to a great start at TCU. I think they were up like 19-3 at one point in that game.
Were they really?
It was a very fluky start.
Wait, and what? That actually happened?
That's a thing that happened. And then they started turning the ball over, and Markel Fultz got into foul trouble, and TCU kept scoring, and then scored a little more for good measure, and won 86-71. So the Huskies drop now to 4-3 on the season, entering tonight's matchup at Gonzaga. The first meeting between these two teams on U.S. soil since 2007.
Great.
So they resumed the series last year at the Battle for Atlantis a year ahead of time. This is the start of the regular scheduled series, which will shift to Seattle next year, but resumed in Spokane. Despite the fact that it was last played in Spokane, don't ask me to explain the math on that one.
Yeah, what the hell? We're angry about this. So, and the Huskies obviously would win if it was here.
Yeah, it's true. Gonzaga off to an 8-0 start so far. They were the victors in the Advocare Invitational in, I believe that's in Orlando, at the Magic Kingdom, beating Florida and Ohio and Iowa State in the last two
games.
It's
not in the Magic Kingdom in Iowa City.
No, sadly no. And then last Saturday, they beat Arizona at the Staples Center in another neutral floor matchup. And they're very good. They are an experienced team that starts three transfers, including Nigel Williams-Goss, who you'll recall from the Huskies.
Never heard of him.
Playing his first two seasons with the Huskies, but also Jordan Matthews, who was at Cal last year as a grad transfer for them, and then Jonathan Williams, who was a really promising player at Missouri for 2 years, who transferred in and is making his debut this year. To go along with a couple of holdovers, they've gotten some really nice plays so far from Josh Perkins, who's their leading three-point shooter. And
all of these people sound like football players from other colleges.
They really do. And then Silas Melson is their last starter, is a junior. They start a fifth year junior, or I guess he's a fourth year junior, but has 3 years of college experience. Two fourth year seniors, two fourth year juniors, a sophomore and a junior, is compared to the Huskies, who start a JC transfer senior, three sophomores and a freshman.
How is Gonzaga? So, I mean, first off.
How is Gonzaga? That's like a great question. Oh, I didn't even mention Shimek Karnowski, who's back for his fifth year at Gonzaga. I had their wrong starting lineup because that's not the starting lineup they're starting. Karnowski is starting. He's a fifth-year senior who got an extra year after he missed most of last season due to back trouble. So this is, again, an extremely experienced team that also brings some talent. They've got an All-American freshman, Zach Collins, coming off the bench.
I think I have three questions for you.
Okay.
Number one, why? Number two, how? Number three, how dare you? First question is, how is Gonzaga getting all of these transfers?
I mean, first off, people know that if they go to Gonzaga, they're going to be playing for an NCAA tournament team. You can basically write that in, since I believe it's now 19 years and counting that they've made the NCAA tournament.
Okay.
Which is a perk of being in the West Coast Conference at times, but they've also obviously merited above and beyond being in a one-bid league. And I think this year, the West Coast Conference, Santa Clara is off to a, or not Santa Clara.
St. Mary's.
St. Mary's is off to a terrific start. BYU may be a tournament team, so they could get three teams in this year.
Is there something about their grad transfer rules that are more lax than Washington's?
Well, I think everyone's grad transfer rules are more lapse than Washington, which has never had a grad transfer in
but
the history.
But these are just
the
regular transfers.
Matthews, like I said, was a grad transfer. Williams-Goss and Jonathan Williams were not.
Okay.
And so Williams-Goss is fascinating because, of course, he played 2 years at UW. He was someone who came in and everyone expected him to be in the NBA by this point. He didn't prove to be that kind of an athlete, even though he's a very skilled player. And then the results didn't come in terms of wins and losses at UW. And that's why he decided to transfer to Gonzaga, sit out a year, kind of, it's very much the Dan Dickow plan, and try to parlay that into making the NBA.
I forgot that Dan Dickow came here.
Yeah.
Man.
That was a long time ago.
That would have been good for some 90s basketball trivia. My second question is Gonzaga the new Oregon for us? So we had Oregon football with, I mean, granted, we don't play them every year. We had Oregon football that the Huskies could not overcome. Is Gonzaga the same as Oregon football for the basketball program?
Well, it has been what now? Let's see here. It was 2005 that we beat Gonzaga?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, it was 2005, Brandon Roy's senior year. So it's been 12 years since we beat Gonzaga. But on the other hand, we've only played them three times in that span. So I don't know if that quite
counts.
I'm just
projecting all the losses in between.
Oh, no, that's actually not true. We beat Gonzaga in 2006 in Spokane.
Oh, hello.
I had no idea about that, but that is a thing that happened. I have no recollection of that game. So there we go.
Okay.
So it's only been a decade since we've beaten Gonzaga.
Number three, this is more of a statement. You'd like to pick up the series with Gonzaga being in a different place.
And I think the kind of Huskies kind of expected when they resumed the series that they would be, because at that point, no one imagined that DeJounte Murray and Marquise Chris were both going to be in the NBA. In which case, the series would be in a different point.
Okay. Great.
So,
percentage chances of victory?
Ken Pomeroy says 15%.
Really?
That seems about reasonable.
Hey, that's a chance.
You're telling me there's a chance.
That's,
I mean, it's
not zero.
It's one game.
They're not going to
win.
There's
a chance.
There's a 0% chance. Come on.
Oh, wow.
They're not going to win. They're going to go into Gonzaga and win against one of the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Gonzaga, if Ken Pom says a 9% chance of winning, I've dramatically overstated this.
I mean, there's maybe a 2% chance. It's just not going to happen. It would take, what would it take for them to win? Some sort of freakish performance from Markelle Fultz? Every single player playing to the best of their abilities?
Markelle Fultz going off seems like the most likely scenario that would result in a win.
Okay.
Gonzaga, so far this year, you know, historically they've been a much better offensive team than defense. That's been true this year as well. They're 13th in adjusted offensive efficiency on KenPom, 28th in adjusted defensive efficiency, which is obviously very good in its own right, but partially because of the fact that so far they've allowed opponents to shoot 27.5% from three-point range, is we'll probably discuss repeatedly on the podcast. Teams have almost no control over what their opponents shoot from three-point range, particularly over small samples. That is a complete fluke that will eventually even out to league average.
And hopefully quickly. And then what about... Did you have any thoughts
That's the gambler's fallacy.
To bring it back to Washington State College basketball, did you have any thoughts about Klay Thompson last night?
So that was a lot of fun to watch. He had 60 points in 29 minutes. I watched the first half of that game when he scored 40 points. Didn't see the third quarter when he got up to 60.
You changed the channel.
Look, my schedule said I had to watch Lakers Jazz, so I had to watch Lakers Jazz.
Wow. I mean, your schedule doesn't allow for any...
That's not the way a schedule works, my friend.
Wow! Man.
I saw some of it.
No wonder you like The Good Place. You're all about black and white.
I saw some of the third quarter. You know what it reminded me of a little?
What did it remind you of?
Klay Thompson against UW in the 2011 or 2000, I guess it was 2012 Pac-12 tournament?
When he was going off against Isaiah?
Yeah. He did not score 60 points in that game. Spoiler alert.
He had a very good game, though. I mean, I think that was the moment when I think all of us realized that Klay Thompson was a legit NBA player.
It was unclear before that. What was interesting is the year before, you know, Klay Thompson played UW, and I think that game kind of overlearned from it because Klay Thompson, you know, the Huskies destroyed Wazoo. They won that game by 38 points at Heck Ed against a Wazoo team that came into that game at, let's see here, 14-6. And Klay Thompson pouted through the entire second half.
Yeah.
Which is a face that it just does not exist anymore. The Klay Thompson pout face.
He doesn't pout anymore.
No.
Not ever.
He just has no emotion when things go wrong.
Okay. I remember a lot of Klay Thompson pouting in college.
Yeah, it's gone now. It doesn't exist. But yeah, Klay Thompson is an amazing player now.
Okay. And it reminded you of that Pac-12 tournament game.
But you know what though? Hot take. Isaiah Thomas is still better.
Wow. There you go. Better in 2012, better now. Is that a hot take? People hate Isaiah Thomas now, don't they?
No.
I feel like there are Boston fans who think, who are they saying is better, Avery Bradley?
I think, yeah. I mean, I don't think that means they hate Isaiah Thomas.
Okay.
I think that just means they underrate him.
Okay. And being defensive Isaiah Thomas.
He's having a very nice start to the season.
Speaking of Isaiah Thomas, Husky football.
Oh
no, this is Nate Robinson. Just a very different odd, short person.
It's a very odd segue.
As you mentioned, Husky football is in the college football playoff. If you hadn't heard.
Yeah. It's been located. I've kept that under wraps.
What were you thinking on Sunday morning? I mean, aside from not responding to the insane text back and forth between me and Katie, the insane paranoid text back and forth.
Well, so I didn't turn on the TV until right before they showed the Final Four.
And how did you know when they were going to show the Final Four?
I had read it online, probably.
They said when the broadcast started that they didn't have the rankings yet. Was there a specific time that they were going to? Is this an ESPN thing? At ESPN email, and they're like, rankings coming.
Yeah, I got the heads up from Reese Davis.
That's what he was doing during the commercial break, texting you.
Yeah. So they ran through the top three teams pretty quickly, who they had said were obvious, basically, and then that the choice all came down to number four, which is a little odd to me because UW did destroy Colorado in the Pac-12 championship, while Clemson narrowly defeated a much weaker Virginia Tech team in the ACC championship, but whatever.
Sure, yeah. We can't be mad about it now.
So we had to endure a lot of debate about UW versus Michigan and Penn State, and a ramping up of the tension and drama.
Do you feel like there's actually that much tension and drama?
Yeah.
I mean, how nervous were you, though?
I got more nervous the longer it went on. But they didn't say who it was.
Yes. When they showed 1 through 3, and then they come back to the panel.
Right.
Right? And you're like, oh my God, I can't handle this.
Yes.
And it's not even... It was almost like when they announced Washington. I wasn't excited per se. It was just relief.
I think that's a fair assessment.
I would have described a hypothetical presidential candidate from a month ago. Like how I would have felt. It's like not even excitement. It's just like, thank God.
I mean, I would not have been that upset if UW had played in the Rose Bowl.
It's just such a bad opinion. It's such a difference between playing. Okay, imagine
the winner of the Pac-10 or Pac-12 is supposed to play in the Rose Bowl.
Okay, great.
And that's why I think that they should not choose the top four until after the traditional bowl games.
All right, I guess that's not the worst take. It's a bad take still, but it's not the worst take.
Or they should just have no playoff at all and just play the traditional bowl games.
We're on the far opposite ends of this because I want the biggest possible playoff.
You want the 64 team playoff?
I would be happy. Okay.
You know. You said you were okay with that.
Of course I'm okay with that.
Ugh.
What I care about, you know this is what I care about in sports, is keeping hope for as long as possible.
That is true.
Right? I always want a chance. It's like you look at the Pac-12 tournament in college basketball. You go in as the 12 seed. There's still a chance. But you can hold out hope for the entire season, and you always have a chance until the last moment you've lost.
If you're still going to a traditional bowl game, and it's not just about the playoff, then there's still interest in the traditional bowl game. The playoff kills interest in the traditional
bowl. The traditional bowl games should go away completely.
No, they shouldn't.
These are two hot takes. I want bowl games gone forever, and you want to go back to just bowl games. You want to go back to when you have to wait until the next morning to find out who the pollsters determined was the number one team.
I mean, does it really matter who the pollsters say? In my heart, the 91 Tuskies were the national champions.
I mean, it's on the stadium, right? It counts if it's on the stadium. But if the Huskies would have been the number 5 seed and gone to the Rose Bowl and played against, I guess, Michigan in this scenario, maybe?
Yeah, presuming Penn State would have jumped them.
If the Huskies would have won that game, if they would have beaten Michigan, let's say they beat Michigan comfortably, you don't want to know. That's the thing.
That's why I want it after the fact.
That's why, okay, I'll allow that your opinion about having it after the fact is not the worst opinion I've heard. It's still bad. I want at least an 8-team playoff, though.
I don't know if you need the 18 playoff.
You should have spit take about that. 18 playoffs, not that crazy an opinion.
I guffawed.
64 teams might be a little bit more extreme.
I don't think you need the 18 playoff if you do it after the bowl games, because by that point, you've already separated out some of the conference champions.
I suppose so. It's still too much drama. 8 teams means you can have 7 of the best teams, and you can take one crazy wild card team. How much fun would it be for Western Michigan to be in an 18 playoff?
It would be fun. I'm not disputing that.
And then you give the number one seed basically a bye in the first round if they're playing against a team like that. But also, at the same time, if you're Western Michigan, imagine Boise State during Boise State's peak years with Chris Peterson.
Yeah.
If they could sneak into an 18 playoff, how much fun would that be?
That would have been fun.
Oh, it would have been huge. I'd still be a Boise State fan.
But I'm pretty sure the year that they won the Fiesta Bowl, they would have made my Final Four idea post-bowl Final Four.
All right. I'm willing to allow this post-bowl Final Four.
You're coming around to it.
Yeah.
You're coming around.
If we can't have an 18 playoff, I'm okay with that. But it would have been a huge disservice to the season that Washington had they not made the Final Four.
I suppose.
And a team who's much worse would have been in if it weren't for Michigan, right? If Penn State would have been the 4th team, it would be a team who's much worse in every statistical category and on the field. The thing that really bothered me the most about it, I have all these angry points to make as if Penn State got in.
Yes. You really do.
That made me the most angry about it is everybody talking about what a great win they had because they went down 21 points to Wisconsin.
Yep.
It's like maybe you should just beat the crap out of the team from the very beginning and not go down 21 points.
Much as the Huskies did.
The Huskies, I mean, not that they beat the crap out of Colorado. Should the Huskies have gone down? But the thing is, they would have insulted the Huskies. Are we toasting to something?
To beating the crap out of Colorado.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about that. It's old news.
It really is.
But had the Huskies gone down 21 points to Colorado and then come back and won, they wouldn't have gotten the same kind of respect for it. It's this weird Big Ten thing that's happening where every single pundit is a graduate of and former football player at a Big Ten school.
Except Ed Cunningham.
I didn't see too much of him the night before.
He was on. No, he was on the night
was
before.
He?
Yeah.
All right, that's good.
He was repping for UW.
It was just the...
They should have had Joel McHale on with him.
And the impassioned speech. So you didn't watch the first 30 minutes of the show. Kirk Herbstreit being like, what does it say to future schools? This non-conference schedule that Washington had. It's like, what are the messages they're taking from this?
I mean...
Will somebody please think of the non-conference schedules?
Can I be honest with you about something? What? If they had excluded UW on the basis of the non-conference schedule... Like, I don't feel like we could have complained about that. Like, the non-conference schedule was terrible.
I've got lots of complaints about it. Are you ready for them?
Is it going to be that they scheduled Rutgers when they thought Rutgers was a good team? Okay, that's great.
What about when Michigan scheduled Colorado? They just happened to get lucky that Colorado's a good team.
Hey, you know who wasn't a good team when they scheduled them? Either Idaho or Portland State. You can't just schedule one good team and make that a good non-conference schedule. Like, no, this was not an adequate non-conference schedule.
Is that not what Clemson did? They schedule Auburn, and people were saying that that's a great non-conference schedule. They managed to win every game by 2 points, have by far the worst loss of any of the teams who were in consideration with their loss to Pittsburgh.
Let's be clear about something.
We're fighting about something that didn't even happen. We're fighting about the logic of choosing the team.
Having a human committee select the teams is inherently a fruitless and worthless exercise. The only thing that matters is the statistical evidence of how good the team was over the course of the season, and you should only pick teams strictly based on the statistics.
I think that...
But people don't want that.
I don't read computers.
People hate computers.
I think that the Final Four that was eventually chosen, though, was the same as the BCS would have picked.
Yes. I mean, Michigan, let's be honest, was one of the four best teams in the country.
It's just Clemson who wasn't. I'm not saying that we weren't. Clemson wasn't. I understand maybe they don't judge margin of victory, but Clemson was limped their way through the season. And they're the team who I wish the Huskies could have faced the most. This is our roundup podcast. The
Huskies did end up passing Clemson for fourth in FPI. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Clemson, get the hell out of here. Anyway, hope we can play Clemson.
Should we talk a little about Alabama?
Never heard of them. Yeah, why are they in? They didn't have a good non-conference schedule either.
So they're 16.5 point favorites at this point.
I can't believe that spread.
I mean, I can believe it because they're Alabama.
Yes.
Statistically, it is hard to justify. The Football Power Index from ESPN, which I referenced earlier, it puts Alabama as 6-point favorites over UW on a neutral field. And this, granted, playing in Atlanta is not really a neutral field. It's going to be basically an Alabama home game.
Yes.
But... that's still like a 9 or 10 point spread. And an interesting thing, if you go by Football Power Index's team efficiency, which does not include preseason data, just looks at how teams actually performed this year, Alabama's number one in the country, obviously. You know who's number two? University of Washington.
Hello.
3 points back.
Really?
So we're still going to get blown out. Alabama's defense is so good.
I mean, it's not a great... And we're obviously going to preview this game numerous times before it happens.
We are.
But just looking cursory at it, Alabama has an amazing defense, number one defense in the country. But the Huskies have the second best defense in the country. And then
No. Huskies have the second best offense.
Oh, well, okay. The Huskies have a top 10 defense also.
Yes.
And then you look at Alabama offensively. They're good, right? They're a top 25 offense. And then the Huskies have the second best offense in the country. If it weren't for how badly I think Jake Browning in particular played against really good defenses, I think we'd be thinking about this game differently.
Yeah, but Jake Browning did play really badly against really good defenses, and that's a real concern.
And I think that's why the spread is so big. I think people saw that and realized that this is going to be a very difficult game for Jake Browning.
I think you're overestimating how much people watch any football on the West Coast. I think they just looked at this is Alabama versus a team from the Pac-12. It's an automatic 2-touchdown spread.
Yeah. They're like, they beat 59-3.
Again, we're going to talk about this more, but you want to know how good the Alabama defense is?
How good are they?
In the FPI team efficiency, they rate it in 98 out of 100. The next best team, Ohio State, rates in 89.4.
Good God.
The difference between Alabama and Ohio State is as large as Ohio State and Clemson, who's in ninth. Or is larger than, or, yeah.
Well, okay, here's another thought that I had, though.
What's that?
Which is... the two highest point totals given up on the season between Washington and Alabama were both given up by Alabama. Huskies have never given up 30 points in the season. The two highest scoring totals in the season were both by Washington also. So if you look at those two extremes, Washington has been very steady defensively. If they can get to...
So this is a good example of the kind of things you shouldn't look at and should only look at overall performance.
These are the kind of outliers you should throw out.
Yep.
But the Huskies have never had a game where they gave up 48 points. And so I'm saying that there's a possibility, their weakness is there, and it's something, that game tape is something that Chris Peterson can use over these next 3 weeks, right? There are places to look at to see where they have not been perfect. And granted, it's happened with the Huskies also. You know, there's definitely game tape out there for how to beat us, but...
Yeah, it's called the USC game.
at least...
And I think if there's anything to be encouraged about, it's Chris Peterson's track record with an extended period to game plan for his opponent.
Yes.
For example, we'll always remember last year's Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl win over Southern Mississippi.
You know, you'd give Chris Peterson 1 month to prepare for the Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl. He's going to come out strong, right? Oh, man. Going to the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl just doesn't feel the same as going to the Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl.
I feel like we need to get our hands on some Zaxby's and some Chick-fil-A and compare them head-to-head.
There we go.
During the game.
I don't know where we're going to get the Zaxby's. It'll have to be shipped
here. Yeah, it's going to have to be mailed.
I think Chick-fil-A might win that over our shipped Zaxby's. Texas Toast. Do they have Texas Toast?
I've
only heard of it from the conversation about the Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl.
Should we talk about the Seahawks?
Yeah, let's talk about the Seahawks.
Should we pour some out for Earl Thomas? I mean, we're probably not actually going to pour some out. We're in your kitchen. That would be weird.
Really, really messy. Our computers would be destroyed.
It marred Sunday's blowout win over Carolina and to have Earl Thomas lost for the season.
Yep. And we didn't necessarily know, being at the game, exactly what was happening. It was pretty apparent that it was a bad injury. And then...
It's weird because you watch the film and there's nothing obvious. It's not like,
it doesn't,
you know, a
look
knee
that
injury.
Bad.
But
right?
the way he reacted to it and was able, yes, to walk and was taken back to the locker room, that's when it became clear, okay, this is something serious.
I went to the bathroom, and Thomas Rawls, we see on the screen, Thomas Rawls is out of the game in the concussion protocol, right?
Yep.
I come back from the bathroom, and Chris, who's with me, is like, Thomas Rawls is back. Earl Thomas is out for the year.
He really said that?
Yeah.
It's very matter of fact.
It's like, okay.
People were feeling a lot of things on Twitter. I don't know if you knew this, but especially after Earl Thomas's tweet, the feelings were strong.
Oh, that's what he said. He said, Thomas Rawls is back. Earl Thomas is retiring. Not just out for the year.
It seems unlikely that Earl Thomas is going to retire.
You know, I'm not too nervous about that.
We'll prepare. We'll analyze that one when and if we get to it. Should we talk about what his loss for the season means?
Yeah, what does it mean?
So Danny Kelly had a great piece today on The Ringer about what Earl Thomas does for the Seahawks defense and what his absence means. And one of the stats that he had that I helped contribute to was that this season, the Seahawks have given up 4 completions total that have been marked as the deep middle of the field. 2 of those came on Sunday night after Earl Thomas was injured, including that touchdown that Carolina had
on
the very first play. So Earl Thomas basically makes the center of the field a no-fly zone with his defense. And after kind of struggling, I felt like at times last season and early this year, it seemed like he was playing some of his best football in the middle of this season, despite the hamstring injury he had, including on Sunday night. I mean, as he joked about to Richard Sherman while he was down on the ground, the break he had on the play where he was injured was one of the greatest Earl Thomas plays imaginable. He would have had an interception if Richard Sherman had not come across and clipped him.
I thought it was Cam Chancellor.
Was it Cam? I guess so. So it's a tough loss. Now, let's talk about how the Seahawks have done with Stephen Terrell at safety this year, because he's now played halves of 2 games and then the entire Tampa game. And what's interesting is the Seahawks have actually allowed fewer yards per attempt with Terrell on the field, 6.8 yards per attempt, than overall 6.9. Now, I don't quite know what to make of that, because on the one hand, he played a lot of garbage time against Carolina and Philadelphia. But on the other hand, before he came in those games with Earl Thomas at free safety, those teams were averaging 3.3 yards per attempt against the Seahawks. So I really don't know what to make of any of that. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm not that nervous about this.
I mean, I'm nervous about this. Earl Thomas is arguably the best player on the CIS team.
Not even close.
Not even close?
If I had to rank individual Seahawks defensive players who matter the most, I feel like Earl Thomas would maybe be fourth to me.
That to me is preposterous.
Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett, Bobby Wagner, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas.
Cam ahead of Earl?
I think Cam Chancellor to the defense. I mean, partially just because I think Stephen Terrell is really good.
I mean, I think you're getting a little cocky. The one game he started, Jameis Winston did complete 21 of 28 passes for 220 yards.
And that was on Stephen Terrell. They scored 14 points.
It's also true.
It maybe took Stephen Terrell a second to get comfortable, but it's his job now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that first play against Carolina.
You can't blame him for that.
Which, also, they were playing cover two on that one, oddly, instead of the cover three they usually play. So Terrell had farther to range over for that pass. It was basically just a perfect call against cover two. I don't know how Carolina knew that was going to be coming, but they got it exactly
right.
Even
if it was his fault, he doesn't even know he's going to the game. It's the very first play and a long pass against him. Whatever.
All right, the Seahawks defense is number five on the season in DVOA.
Yes.
Where do you think they would rank with Stephen Terrell at free safety?
How about this? Where do I think they will finish?
Okay.
And I think they finish number three.
Number three? You think they're moving up?
They're moving up.
Because of a healthy Michael Bennett?
I mean, you look at all the players who came back last week. If you were to ask me, going into last week, would I rather have Mike Morgan, healthy Thomas Rawls, Michael Bennett, and Justin Britt, and not have Earl Thomas? I'd take all those things.
I didn't know that Justin Britt was going to have such a big impact on the defense of DVOA.
This is not just the defense, but overall, right?
Yes.
Having the rest of the team be healthy is more important than one individual defensive player. Because, I mean, really, when you think about it, the whole defensive unit is the important thing. It's not about one player. It's about how everybody works together. It's about the pass rush that's coming from Michael Bennett.
Yeah, but I think Earl Thomas is a big part of how everyone works together, don't you?
Sure.
I mean, for the challenge with this is we've never seen, other than the Tampa Bay game in the second half of these two games, we have not seen the Seahawks without Earl Thomas. This is a new thing.
Yes, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I think that Cam Chancellor has become the anchor of the back of the defense. Seeing Richard Sherman with Cam Chancellor out is a shocking event.
Cam Chancellor is very important in his own right. I don't know that he's the anchor of the back of the defense, because for the most part, he isn't playing in the back of the defense. For the most part, he's playing in the box.
As far as I know, he's the one who makes the calls generally for the defense and for the secondary. And he's the one who gets them most on the same page. I think Cam Chancellor is underrated. His importance to the defense is underrated. And we've seen it because they have not played as well without Cam Chancellor.
Well, again, we'll see how they play without Earl Thomas.
No, it'll be fascinating. And obviously a big test this week.
Yeah. Even against a lessened Green Bay passing attack with Aaron Rodgers at the helm. So far, surprisingly, they are the 11th best passing offense in terms of DVOA, which is hard to believe for a team with Aaron Rodgers and this year healthy. We thought last year when they dropped off without Jordy Nelson that it was really because of that. And they haven't necessarily entirely bounced back. Rodgers is up in his completion percentage. He completed 60.7% of his passes last year. So far, 64.5% this year. But a career low 10.6 yards per completion.
Really?
Yeah.
And I've definitely noticed this paying attention to Green Bay. I mean,
having multiple wide receivers.
Yes, having multiple Green Bay wide receivers in fantasy, pay a little bit more attention to them. But they are not getting the ball down the field.
Yeah, and that's a little bit tough to understand. Because, again, they've got the talent there to do it, particularly with Jordy Nelson. But just hasn't transpired. They haven't had the same rhythm that I think a couple years ago, and then particularly in 2013 that they had.
What about the rest of the Packers offense outside of Aaron Rodgers?
Well, their rushing game has been fairly disastrous, I would say, since Eddie Lacy went out for the season. James Starks, who's now starting for them at running back, is averaging 2.3 yards per attempt. If we want to put that in feet per attempt, that's 7 feet per carry.
Okay.
Which is not enough.
We should convert everything to feet per attempt.
It's 21 inches. Or no, I'm sorry. It's 84 inches per carry.
So some yards per carry would sound so impressive if you put them into feet per attempt.
It really would. I would say that Ty Montgomery has actually been their most effective running back without Lacy. Because they picked up Christian Michael off waivers after the Seahawks waived him. He hasn't been any good there. I think he had 9 carries for 19 yards last week.
It really hasn't been that much of
remains a slumbering, although you got to worry about the revenge game possibility this weekend. Ty Montgomery, who's actually a wide receiver, has averaged 5.3 yards per carry.
Always like Ty Montgomery.
And also has been a threat out of the backfield. So I think they're best with him back there. Last week, though, was their first week with 100 rushing yards since week 8.
Really?
Yeah. And so you go up against the Seahawks run defense that has always been outstanding. It's hard to see them being very effective moving the ball on the ground unless Kristen Michael really has an amazing revenge game.
I like that you're holding out hope for the Kristen Michael revenge
game. Oh, I'm always holding out hope for Kristen Michael.
What about the Seahawks offense going against Green Bay's defense?
So it's interesting. You know, Green Bay slumped in the middle of the season. And as much as people wanted to put that on Aaron Rodgers, who wasn't, again, playing his best football, it was really about the defense, and specifically, I would say, about Clay Matthews' absence during that stand. You look at the stretch that... So he missed 3 weeks in there. And during that stretch, the Packers allowed 70... Aaron Rodgers allowed. Yes, Aaron Rodgers allowed. 72% completion percentage for 8.6 yards per attempt.
Yeah, Aaron Rodgers allowed 47 points against the Titans.
Before that, Green Bay was giving up 60.3% completions and 7.3 yards per attempt. And then since Clay Matthews came back, he's been back the last 3 weeks, it's at 66.3% for 7.5 yards per attempt. And the other thing you see, which is natural with Clay Matthews, even though he's playing inside linebacker primarily this year instead of as a rush end in the 3-4, their sack rate dropped from 6.8% of dropbacks to 4.9%. And for the season, that's atypical because for the season, they're third best in adjusted sack rate.
But how healthy is Clay Matthews really?
Yeah, so he's still playing through the shoulder injury. I mean, the results have been pretty good the last couple of weeks. It's tough to separate that from the fact that they played Philadelphia and Houston, which are not the most explosive offenses in the league.
I saw that in last week's game. Basically, Clay Matthews is playing with a one arm.
Yeah.
And he didn't do anything. He did not do anything that would show up in a box score.
But their rush defense has been better since he's back. Their pass defense has been better. But besides Clay Matthews, the other guy they're missing is Sam Shields, who was their veteran cornerback. They already had let one of their veterans, Casey Hayward, go after last season. He's now in San Diego. So with Shields out, that leaves them with last year's top two picks, Demarius Randle and Quentin Rollins, starting at cornerback, with another second-year guy, undrafted Ladarius Gunter, in the slot. And that's not been a good combination. The Packers' pass defense ranks 22nd in DVOI, but then when you look at specifically against wide receivers, you know, remember that part of that is that really good pass rush. When they actually get the passes off, Green Bay ranks 32nd out of 32 teams against number one receivers.
My God.
They rank 31st out of 32 teams against number two receivers and 26th against all other receivers. So if the Seahawks can protect for Russell Wilson, there's some big plays out there because they're also 31st, better than only San Francisco, against deep passes.
So you have to bring up the weather for this one.
Yes. Because, you know, we said it was going to be cold and clear in Toronto on Saturday?
Yes.
Well, on Sunday in Green Bay, snow showers, high of 31, low of 12.
Yeah, low of 12 everywhere. Seattle teams are playing this weekend.
And the game that game kicks off at, I believe, 3:25 Central Time.
Oh, man.
It's going to be dark by the end of this game.
So it's a 1 o'clock Pacific start.
1:25,
yeah. Another 1 o'clock Pacific start for the Seahawks.
You know, it's the national game of the week on Fox as part of their doubleheader. Kind of surprising that this isn't a Sunday night game, but the Cowboys always play on Sunday night now.
Yeah, just like last week. It'll be interesting to see how much the Seahawks are able to get the ball down the field given the weather, though. And that's the thing that makes me the most nervous about the Seahawks offense. How does Green Bay generally do against the run?
They've been pretty good against the run. Like I said, not as good during the time Matthews missed. They allowed 4.2 yards per carry during that span. They're 3.8 over the course of the season. What's interesting is they're number 3 in adjusted line yards on defense.
Okay.
And what that means is their front 7 has been really good against the run. If you can get to the second level, their safeties have kind of struggled, and they've given up a lot of big carries so far this season. So you could see Thomas Rawls break off a long carry like he did last week.
You know, I mean, you look at these linebackers also, injuries across their entire linebacking core, players who may play, but nobody is 100% for them. Clay Matthews is nowhere near 100%. And then also starting linebackers Jake Ryan and Nick Perry have been on and off the field with injuries.
Yeah, Nick Perry left last game with a hand injury. And that's a big deal for him because this is a guy who was seen as kind of a bust coming into this season, but has broken through this year and leads them with 8 sacks ahead of Julius Peppers with 6.5 and then Matthews with 4.
But coming back to that weather, the run game is going to be so important on both sides of the ball.
And that's, I mean, if it is a running heavy game, that certainly favors the Seahawks.
It also is something, though, that might favor a little bit kind of the garbage that Green Bay puts together, especially has this last season, where I think it's going to be tough for the Seahawks defense to get off the field.
I mean, the thing that worries me is thinking back to, I can't even remember what year that was in the playoffs now. It was not 2003. It was not snowy in that game. But the year where the Seahawks played in Green Bay in the second round, and it was snowy, and that was just kind of a miserable game
against
altogether.
Brett Favre. That's what you're talking about?
Was Brett Favre the quarterback still?
Yeah, Brett Favre and Ryan Grant. I think it was Brett Favre in Pete Carroll's first year. They just
beat the Saints. it was not Pete Carroll's first year. That was against Chicago that year.
And they played Chicago.
Also, Aaron Rodgers was definitely the quarterback by then. I think it was Brett Favre's last year in Green Bay, which was 2007. And indeed, the Seahawks lost.
Scoring 2 touchdowns immediately.
The Seahawks lost 14-3 in that game.
Huh.
Could not get much going offensively.
I'm going to go ahead and say that that's not going to have too much bearing on this one.
28 rushing yards in that one.
What I think about is going back to last season's game against Green Bay, which was a Sunday night game at the beginning of the year.
Oh, wait, no, I misread that score, didn't I? It was 42-20 in that game. Record was
14-3 after the first four minutes of that game.
Their record went to 14-3. Brett Favre, 18 of 23 for 173 yards. Ryan Grant, 27 carries for 201 yards in that game.
I remember that game being really terrible.
And Sean Alexander,
knowing we had no chance of winning.
Sean Alexander, 9 carries for 20 yards.
Man, who did we beat in the first round that year?
That was, I believe that was Washington that year.
But I think back to the Sunday night game that the Seahawks played at Green Bay last year, where they had such a difficult time getting off the field. Aaron Rodgers had tons of time to find open receivers. And again, third downs were the huge play. We'll see if things like hard counts are able to draw the Seahawks offsides again. Do you remember that?
Has got to be disappointed in this game. He can't just light up offsides. Like, it was, like, Pete Carroll could laugh about it this week. Next week, he's not going to be able to laugh about Michael Bennett just lighting up offsides.
But that's the thing that genuinely makes me nervous and maybe isn't as affected by the snow because they're running shorter routes.
I know, you can't see the line of scrimmage.
No, that could be affected by the snow. I'm saying Green Bay's short offense.
Yeah.
And if they can pick up, maybe they can't pick up a ton on the ground, but if they can do 2 yards in a pile of dust on first down, 4 yards on second down, 4 yards on second down, these short,
they're
short
getting
pass,
2 second downs?
Four yards on second down. With these short passes that they hit to people like Devontae Adams and Randall Cobb, and if they're just able to stay on the field and grind it out, it's going to be a long day for the Seahawks.
I mean, that sounds a lot like the New Orleans game.
At the same time, on the other side of the ball, I really think the Seahawks will be able to run the ball in this game. And if they are able to break off big plays, it could change. All of a sudden, this dink and dunk stuff that the Packers do is not going to work. I mean, you look at these games that they've played, the kind of points that they've given up this season. Doing things like that has not been enough if they're able to get to the situation where they're giving up 47 against Tennessee, 42 against Washington, 33 against Atlanta, 31 against Indianapolis. If the Seahawks get anywhere near those point totals, if they put up 28 points in this game, there's going to be a lot of pressure on Green Bay's offense because not a lot of teams score that many points on the Seahawks defense.
It's true. I mean, the Washington game, Matthews was back for. Generally, those games were when he was out, and I don't think that's coincidental.
I'm just not willing to accept that Clay Matthews is...
I am willing to accept that he's that important.
I'm willing to accept that he's that important, but that he's 100%, and that his impact will be the same throughout this game. I mean, let's just say I wouldn't be surprised if Clay Matthews didn't finish this game.
Okay.
Playing a physical
game. Thanks, Doctor.
Against a physical team. Thanks, Doctor. I'm going to predict a lot more. I'm going to predict that you're not going to finish this game.
Well, after the snowball, it's going to be tough.
Playing a physical game against a physical team in the snow and the cold, I think it's going to be difficult for players to finish it. It's going to be dark. It's going to be very cold.
I think they'll get through it. Do you want to do chances of victory here?
50%.
I was going to say 50% as well. The Seahawks are 2.5-point favorites.
That's insane.
That to me is a little excessive.
I think that the Packers should be... I think it should either be a pick'em or the Packers should be favored by 1.5.
That's a wide range. You don't think they should be favored by 0.5? They should be favored by 1.5?
I'm giving 1.5. All
right. Fair enough.
I think the Packers should be favored in the game, though.
Or it should be a pick'em, which yes. is not them being favored. But under no circumstance do you think the Seahawks should be favored.
No, especially not by 2.5.
People just didn't apparently have not read the weather report.
Not read the weather report and are underrating the Packers at this point.
Yeah.
And the Packers are playing for their lives. The Seahawks really aren't. They're playing for the number 2 seed, but...
The 2 seed in some ways is their lives. I did want to say, by the way, we haven't talked about this at all, fortunately. I want to declare a moratorium on talking about the SB. People are talking way too much about the SB and like how Earl Thomas's chance injury affects the chances of that. Like, let's just clinch a playoff spot first, okay? Can we just all calm down?
Who is talking about this?
I feel like a lot of people are talking about this. You're not hearing about this?
Oh, it's major jumping to conclusions.
I agree.
I mean, they have no chance of being the number 2 seed. They have a 3% chance of being the number 1 seed. A 3% chance. Have the Seahawks ever gone to the Super Bowl when they are not the number 1 seed?
As I've always said, correlation is causation. Yeah. I mean, this is causation. I've always said small sample size are always predictive going forward.
The sample size is not that small at this point. Three times. 3 times the Seahawks have been the number 1 seed. 3 Super Bowls.
If someone makes 3 shots, they're never going to miss again.
Think of all the times that they haven't been the number 1 seed and have not gone to the Super Bowl.
It's true.
It's a lot bigger sample size. We're nowhere near that conversation yet.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we're on the same page here.
Why would I be talking about that?
I don't know. I feel like people are talking about that.
The only way that I would talk about that is if they'd won the NFC Championship game.
That's an excellent, excellent argument.
Because the only game that matters is the next game on the schedule.
Thanks, Coach. Dr. Incoach. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.